From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Nearly 8,000 physicians are calling for government-run universal health insurance system that would cover the entire nation. We'll speak to Dr. David Satcher, one of the two former U.S. Surgeon Generals who are endorsing the plan. Many people believe the last presidential election was stolen by the Supreme Court. Could the next election be stolen at the ballot box? We'll take a look at the controversy surrounding electronic voting machines. And we'll go to Chiapas in southern Mexico to hear Marcos and the Zapatistas on their far-reaching decision to step back from the guerrilla movement and move towards political autonomy. Finally, the CIA warned of a post-invasion Iraqi resistance prior to the U.S. attack on Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A British citizen was arrested in Newark, New Jersey yesterday for allegedly trying to sell a shoulder-fired missile to an undercover agent. Two Afghan men allegedly connected to the plot were also arrested in New York. The Los Angeles Times identified the arms dealer as Hamad Lakhani, an Englishman of Indian descent. The FBI, along with British and Russian agents, have been involved with the case since October when the man bought a disarmed missile from Russian officials. He was then allowed, with help from U.S. agents, to transport the missile into the U.S. Once he was in the United States, he attempted to sell the missile to U.S. agents posing as members of Al-Qaeda. It was a complex double sting operation, says the government. The BBC reports it's unlikely the man would have ever been able to smuggle the missile into the United States if he wasn't being duped by U.S. agents. The Washington Post quotes an official saying, quote, "There's no credible information that terrorists are in control of these kinds of missiles in this country." Officials also disputed notions that the arms dealer was motivated out of support for Al-Qaeda. The unnamed official noted the man was not a Muslim and said, quote, "I think he was out for the buck. He just wanted to make some money." Some governmental officials alleged the real significance of the case was not that they'd caught a low-level arms dealer, but that U.S. and Russian agents were able to work so closely on the case. While most papers ran the arrest on page one, the Washington Post downplayed the entire incident. It appears on the 28th page in today's newspaper. Palestinian and Israeli leaders yesterday joined together to condemn the pair of suicide attacks which killed two Israelis and wounded many others on Tuesday. Although the attacks occurred 40 minutes apart, Israeli officials said yesterday they did not appear to be coordinated. One of the bombings was claimed by Hamas, the other by the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Despite protests from Muslim groups, President Bush is expected to sidestep Congress and directly appoint controversial Middle East analyst Daniel Pipes to the federally funded U.S. Institute of Peace. Congressional sources told Reuters yesterday Pipes will soon receive a recess appointment from Bush. Pipes' nomination had been stalled in the Senate for months. Pipes has been called the country's leading Islamophobe. He claims up to 15% of Muslims are, quote, potential killers. He says Muslim government police officers, soldiers and diplomats, quote, need to be watched for connections to terrorism. Ibrahim Hooper, spokesman for the Council on American Islamic Relations, called the move, quote, a defeat for democracy and an affront to Muslims, Arab Americans and all those who seek peace. Hooper went on to say, quote, Pipes' appointment would call into question all of President Bush's previous statements claiming that the war on terrorism is not an attack on Islam. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. You can put into our search engine Pipes and Hooper, and you will get a discussion we had earlier this year with the two of them about the Pipes nomination. The Wall Street Journal is reporting some of the nation's highest paid CEOs will reap tens of millions of dollars in tax breaks under Bush's new plan that slashes the tax rate on dividends. The Journal estimates Bill Gates, head of Microsoft, will earn $80 million more. The CEO of Viacom, which owns CBS, Sumner Redstone, will make $40 million. And Sanford Weill, head of Citigroup, will take an additional $17 million. A group of about 600 U.S. military families are launching a campaign today to call on Congress and President Bush to bring U.S. troops home from Iraq now. The group has set up a website, bringthemhomenow.com, that features letters from troops in Iraq and their loved ones here in the United States. This news from Chile. President Ricardo Lagos has announced a plan to pay compensation to thousands of families who had relatives killed during the military regime of General Augusto Pinochet. Pinochet oversaw the killing of at least 3,000 Chileans during his reign, as well as many others, which lasted from 1973 to 1990. His coup was backed by then-President Nixon and Secretary of State National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger. In a decision issued Monday, a federal judge in Boston wrote the U.S. is likely executing innocent people, but he declined to rule the death penalty unconstitutional. The judge, Mark Wolf, wrote, quote, "In the past decade, substantial evidence has emerged to demonstrate that innocent individuals are sentenced to death and undoubtedly executed much more than previously understood. A new study in Vietnam has found Agent Orange used by U.S. troops still contaminates food supplies in Vietnam. The study found, quote, markedly elevated levels of dioxin, TCDD, in samples of chickens, ducks, pork, beef, and fish. Vietnam estimates 1 million people were exposed to Agent Orange, which was used by the U.S. from 1962 to 1971. In Maine, over the weekend, 13 Plowshares activists were arrested at a protest outside Bath Ironworks, where the shipyard was unveiling its newest destroyer. Among those arrested, Elizabeth McAllister of Baltimore. The peace protesters also christened their own peace ship, dedicated to McAllister's late husband, Philip Berrigan, one of the founders of the Plowshares movement. In Venezuela, striking workers have shut down a drilling plant operated by the U.S. company Halliburton. The workers claimed Halliburton, which was headed by Vice President Dick Cheney before he ran for office, had withheld back wages. And finally, this news just in from Afghanistan. At least 15 people have died in an explosion that tore apart a bus in southern Afghanistan. It's not known who carried out the attack, but the area has seen an increase in violence caused by the newly reformed Taliban. Meanwhile, Afghan troops have shot dead 8 suspected militants along the Pakistan border.
Amber waves of grain.
You're listening to Democracy Now! That's Ray Charles, America the Beautiful. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 8,000 physicians, including two former U.S. Surgeon Generals, are calling for a government-run universal health insurance system. In a special communication to the prestigious journal, the American Medical Association, or JAMA, the doctors wrote yesterday that Americans are overpaying for medical care and point out 41 million people lack any kind of health insurance at all. They argue universal health care systems would not only be more fair, but would be cheaper and more efficient than the current patchwork system. Medicare and Medicaid offer care to patients who are old enough, disabled enough, or poor enough to qualify for the state federal health plan. But many doctors do not participate. States trying to balance budgets have been forced to cut Medicaid and Medicare services. Unlike countries such as Canada, Britain, and France, the United States relies on a combination of private and government health care. Most Americans are insured through their employers, but small employers are not required and not often able to provide health insurance. Former Surgeon General Julius Richmond, who served under President Carter, and Dr. David Satcher, a Case Western Reserve School of Medicine graduate who served under President Clinton, endorsed the plan. Dr. David Satcher joins us on the telephone. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. I'm delighted to be with you.
It's good to have you on with us. Well, lay out what you have written to the Journal of the American Medical Association and what you said in your news conference yesterday.
Well, I think you've described it pretty well, but I think the two major characteristics of this proposal are, one, universal coverage. It is critical that all people in this country have access to health care. And it begins with universal coverage. As you know, right now, over 41 million people are uninsured, and probably that number at least underinsured. And those numbers are going up as more people lose their jobs, as more employers decide that they cannot afford to cover their employees. The other component that's so critical is it is possible to do this without any increase in cost. It is possible to save up to $200 billion from administrative costs, and that has been verified by the Congressional Budget Office and GAO. So it is possible to find $200 billion of savings in the present system. We spend 42% more per capita than the next highest-paying country in the world in terms of health care. So we pay more than anybody else, more per capita, a larger percentage of our gross national product, and yet we have so many people uninsured. However, I should point out, Amy, that it's not just the uninsured. There are many Americans who have insurance, but it doesn't necessarily cover mental health. And when a family member has a mental health problem, they are not necessarily covered. If so, they're covered inadequately. And the other issue, of course, is long-term care, where many people work all their lives to save and to purchase homes. And then when they suffer a very critical illness like Alzheimer's, their families might have to sell everything they have in order to provide long-term care. This proposal would cover long-term care, mental health care, dental care, and all the other things that people really need to be human in this country, to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
We're talking to former Surgeon General Dr. David Satcher, who has come out for universal health care in this country. Can you talk about the racial disparities in who gets covered these days and who doesn't?
Well, as you know, one of the goals of Healthy People 2010, which I helped to develop as Surgeon General and Assistant Secretary for Health, is the goal of eliminating disparities in health among different racial and ethnic groups in this country. There's growing diversity in this country, and diversity should be one of our major strengths. However, there are major problems in terms of access to care for Hispanics and African Americans in this country, disproportionately left out. Over 30% of Hispanics are uninsured, over 20% of African Americans. We are never going to begin to eliminate disparities in health as long as people don't have access to health care. So we're very concerned about that. But I also want to point out that in addition to the concern about the poor and minorities, all Americans are paying a price for this system that is not functioning efficiently. And the World Health Organization in 2000, ranked us number 37th in terms of health system efficiency, despite the fact that we're number one in terms of cost.
Dr. David Satcher, who are the forces that are fighting against this? If you ask most people in this country how they feel, what would they say? And who is shaping public opinion right now?
I think most studies show that the majority of Americans favor a national health plan. I think most of the studies that have been done, most academic physicians, most deans of medical schools favor a national health plan. I think the problem in this country is that health is treated as a commodity to be traded in the marketplace to the highest bidder. And I don't think you can sustain a health care system. We don't really have a health care system. We have a disease care system because you make more money treating diseases. So we could prevent many of the diseases that we treat and many of their complications, but there's not a lot of money in preventing diseases and promoting health. And so there's not an incentive for us to do that. So less than 2% of our health budget, less than 2% is spent on population-based prevention. So we have this tremendous rise in type 2 diabetes, tremendous rise now in childhood and adult obesity, threatening to increase again cardiovascular deaths and cancer deaths, as well as certainly a continuing increase in diabetes. But I think it's the marketplace treatment of health that's our problem, and we have to find a way to say that that health is a right, that people deserve to be healthy. They deserve the chance to have optimal health, and it's good for the country. It's good for the security of the country. It's good for the health of the country for people to be healthy, and we should invest in that.
Have you evaluated the presidential candidates announced so far in regard to their stand on universal health care?
No, I have not evaluated them, and I want to, because I don't want to get into the politics yet. I tried as Surgeon General to be credible by not being political, and as we make this proposal, I would love to see a presidential candidate, of course, of merit come out and support this proposal, but I think it would be very early for me to criticize their proposal. I don't think there is a proposal on the table that completely matches the one that JAMA will publish today, providing universal coverage, doing away with the tremendous administrative costs that characterize our system, and covering long-term care, mental health care, dental care. There may be one that comes very close, but I'm not ready to get political with this yet.
Dr. Satcher, what will be your strategy and the strategy of the organization that you're working with right now, Physicians for National Health Plan?
Well, I think the first strategy is education, because I think most people feel that it's virtually impossible to cover everybody in this country and to do so without increased costs. You talk to business leaders, and they'll tell you that their costs for covering their employees going up double digit. I was talking to one yesterday who said that their costs went up 30% in the last year. So many employers are not able to cover their employees, and that sometimes means going out of business and or laying off people.
But what does education mean? I mean, this has been going on for so long. What most people hear is that Canadian universal health care doesn't work.
Well, but I think, number one, I think it does work. It might well be that people might complain of waiting longer for elective procedures, but I don't think there are many people in the world that would say that the Canadian system doesn't work for the health of the Canadian people. And that's why we're having the difficulty now with Americans trying to figure out how to get medications going to Canada. So I think I'm not saying the Canadian system is perfect, but I am saying that we have the ability in this country to maintain our tremendous research enterprise, which is so characteristic of our health system, our great training programs, and at the same time provide coverage for everybody, and to do so without increased costs.
I guess the question I'm asking is not as much what the Canadian Health Plan is about, but for years the insurance companies, in partnership, in bed with the politicians, have managed to preserve private health insurance in this country. And I'm wondering what would change now, what kind of strategy and coalitions are being formed in this election year that might turn this around.
Well, I think it's really important for all sectors to understand what this proposal means for them, since we're at a point in our history when everybody seems to be frustrated with the health system, not just patients, not just the poor. Payors are frustrated. Physicians are frustrated. And every time there's an announced cut in Medicaid and Medicare, more physicians leave practice or stop seeing patients that they've been committed to. So I think what we need to do is to educate people about what this means for them, not just the poor, not just for minorities, but what does this mean for employers, major payers, who would like to provide care for their employees, but are finding it very difficult to do so. So this strategy, I think, is to really put a proposal on the table, a very simple proposal, not complicated. I was involved in the Clinton proposal. I helped put it together. I know in retrospect that it was far too complicated and in some ways maybe too political. And I think what this proposal is a very simple proposal that will allow us to cover everybody and to provide for the health needs of the American people and to do so without increased cost. And I find it very difficult to see how we can say no to that if we really care about the health of our people.
Senator Lieberman has accused Congressman Gephardt of putting forth a break-the-bank proposal for national health care. And I think Dennis Kucinich, the congressmember from Ohio, Cleveland, has talked about universal health care.
Yeah, I think Congressman Kucinich's proposal is probably closest to this. Clearly, this proposal has been evaluated by the Congressional Budget Office and the GAO, and it is clear that this proposal is affordable. We can cover all of the American people using, and we can add those who are uninsured now, based on the savings that we will acquire from the decrease in administrative costs. And it's not just administrative costs in dollars. It's all of the time that physicians spend filling out forms, all of the people that hospitals have to hire to fill out the various forms that are involved in this system. The overhead is just tremendous, probably 13% to 15% of costs now related to that. And we know we can do better because in Medicare, for example, it's only 3%. So we know that we can do much better in terms of administrative costs of running the system. So we can answer that question, I think we have in this proposal, about the affordability. This proposal is affordable. It can The $1.6 trillion that we're now paying for care of the in the health system can provide for all of the people in this country, and it will include long-term care, mental health coverage, dental coverage, and all of the things that people need to maintain optimal health.
Well, Dr. David Satcher, I want to thank you for being with us. If people want to get a hold of the plan, where can they go on the web?
Well, JAMA is publishing it today, and you can access it. JAMA's publication is coming out today, and it can be accessed. Yeah.
That's the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Right.
Dr. David Satcher, thanks for joining us. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, some say it was the Supreme Court that stole the 2000 election. What will happen in this one? Will it be stolen by electronic voting machines or those who can hack them? Stay with us.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. You preach a man, don't tell me. Heaven is under the earth. You are dopey and you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold, and half a story has never been told. So now we see the light. We gonna stand up for our rights. Come on, get up, stand up. Brothers, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up,
sisters,
don't give up the fight.
I'm begging you,
get up, stand up.
Peter Tosh, stand up. Get up, stand up, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Many people say the last presidential election was stolen by the Supreme Court. Voting rights activists say the next election could be stolen at the ballot box. Millions of voters will be using electronic voting machines for the first time, and questions about their security are rife. Hundreds of computer scientists say electronic touchscreen voting machines could allow for massive election fraud. Already, malfunctioning software has caused confusion or possibly faulty vote tallies in races across the country. A recent study out of Johns Hopkins University says that AccuVote machines are vulnerable to hackers, multiple votes, and vote switching. The machines are built by Diebold Voting Systems of McKinney, Texas, and used in a third of the precincts where electronic voting is already in place. Diebold also has extensive ties to the Republican Party. Company officials say they don't know whether the code examined by Johns Hopkins researchers was used in actual elections. In response to the Johns Hopkins report, Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich postponed a nearly $56 million contract with Diebold for 11,000 more voting machines. A private consultant is now reviewing the technology behind Diebold's touchscreen machines. The proliferation of electronic voting machine contracts comes in the wake of the $3.9 billion Help America Vote Act, approved by Congress last November. The legislation requires tougher security, usability, and accuracy standards. The act also mandates all voting systems be updated by 2006 and allocates millions of dollars for purchase of new electronic machines. We attempted to reach representatives from Diebold and from the Federal Elections Commission. Neither returned our phone calls. But joining us instead, Dan Wallach, professor of computer science at Rice University, co-author of the Johns Hopkins report called Analysis of an Electronic Voting System, and Bev Harris, author of Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. She uncovered the public internet site where Diebold's source code was posted. Well, let's start with Dan Wallach. Can you tell us what the Johns Hopkins University report found?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here today. We found several interesting things when we were looking at Diebold's source code. We were focusing on the source code for the touchscreen terminals, not the rest of the system. But what we found was very disturbing. You use these smart cards. These are credit card-sized plastic cards. When you walk into the polling place, somebody hands you one of these things, and you shove it into the computer, type your PIN, and it's supposed to only allow you to vote once. But the way that the computer interacts with the smart card is actually very trivial to forge. So anybody could manufacture the counterfeit cards, and the machine would not be able to distinguish the real ones from the ones that you brought in yourself. And that means any voter could cast as many ballots as they'd like. And it doesn't take too much imagination to see where that can cause problems.
Explain that one more time. How can they cast as many votes as they want? I think this has hardly been covered in this country. And as we move into this election, people are just beginning to pay attention.
Right. So to be clear, you can make your own smart card, and the smart card that you program yourself, these things, by the way, only cost a couple dollars to purchase, and then you can program your smart card. When the voting machine sends it a message that says, okay, you should be canceled now, it just ignores that message. And thus, as long as you can stand there in the privacy of the voting place, you can cast as many ballots as you have time to punch in before you start, arousing suspicion. So maybe that means you could cast 10 votes. Maybe it means you could cast 20 votes. I don't know how fast you can press the buttons.
Now, what about the criticism of the report by Diebold that you didn't actually have the right source code?
Yeah, so this is a very technical...
And what does that mean for people who are not computer literate?
Okay, sure. So source code is what programmers write. It's in a programming language like C or C++. And in addition to instructions that tell the computer how to work, you can put commentary in the code that explains what you're thinking, what you're planning on doing next, just to crib notes to yourself so you know what you're doing. Well, the files that Diebold left on their website that we were able to analyze have all of their source code to the voting terminal and to other things, and not just and there are dates in there. You can see that the stuff we looked at was dated February, March of 2002, but we had like 2 years worth of history. We could turn the clock back and see what their source code looked like at any point in that time period.
And what does that prove?
Well, so the code that we looked at was almost certainly if it wasn't the real code that was used in the November 2002 elections, it was certainly very closely related to it. You don't just throw something like this out and redo it from scratch overnight. So this code is certainly close enough that there's no way they could have fixed all of the problems that we found in such a short time.
Bev Harris, your book is coming out very shortly, Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. Can you talk about the significance of the possibilities of fraud?
Well, yes. What we need to understand is that elections have been tampered with for 2,000 years. It's kind of part of the deal. Like, if you have a bank, you need to figure out how to protect yourself against bank robbers, because that's part of the deal with the bank. With elections, it's always been part of the deal with every system we've ever had. And so our challenge now is to say, okay, given that we've moved to a new electronic system, what kinds of things might we expect in terms of, a new electronic ways to tamper with the election? We certainly shouldn't expect that people are going to change the whole nature of human nature just because we've decided to go to computers. We've still got the same flawed human nature, and so we're still going to have problems with it. And so therefore, studies like Dan Wallach has participated in are very, very important, because what he's doing is looking at some of the different vulnerabilities of the system. In my experience, and I've also worked some with financial fraud, is whenever there's a vulnerability, somebody will exploit that vulnerability. Sooner or later, it will happen. So you have to do as much as you possibly can to shut those things off. And indeed, the Diebold system is pretty riddled with flaws.
Let me ask Dan Wallach about the other ways that people could hack the system. You've got the smart cards that could be put in. Someone could vote multiple times. What are the other ways?
Okay, so we noticed several different things. Another possibly disturbing in an election, it's very important that nobody but you knows who you voted for, and that you can't prove who you voted for to somebody else. Otherwise, they could, be bribing you to vote in a certain way. The way the Diebold system works, it actually records all the votes on the storage card in exactly the order that they're cast. And they might transmit that across a modem, so that way the Election Central can get an early count. Well, because they did the cryptography in such a broken fashion, anybody who can listen in on the telephone, and that's not hard to do, can figure out, exactly the order in which the votes were cast and who they were cast for. And it doesn't take much rocket science from there to figure out, exactly who voted for whom. So now, in addition to people being able to potentially cast multiple ballots, it's also possible to tie, to provably tie who every individual voter voted for. And that's obviously a bad thing. And let's see, what else did we find? Another thing is that we were looking at just the overall quality of the software engineering. We're asking the question, is there any evidence in the code that these people knew what they were doing when they were developing it? And what we saw was very disturbing to us. We saw code that wasn't even sufficient such a quality that you might consider making a video game this way. I mean, the code was not written in a professional fashion, and that's kind of scary to us.
What about the computer chip being programmed in such a way that no matter how people voted when they went into the voting booth, it would register in a particular way?
Well, one of the curious things we found, when you have what's called a ballot image, that's the thing that says, Alice is running for this office, Bob is running for that office, etc. When you vote for, let's say you have an election that has Alice, Bob, and Charlie all running for an office, when you vote for Alice, it doesn't say Alice got one vote, Bob got one vote. It says the candidate number one got one vote, candidate number two got two votes, etc. So if you can change the order in which the candidates appear on the screen, you might press the button for Alice, but it really gets counted for Bob. And we found that you could actually do that. You could get it, so what's so-called administrator access to one of these terminals, and you could reorder the candidates. And so if one person goes in the morning and does that, another person comes later in the day and undoes it, then everybody voting that day for Alice might actually have their votes counted for Bob, which is not really what they wanted.
Bev Harris, what about the company, Diebold? Can you talk about who they are, their connections to those in power, to the Republican Party?
First of all, you need to understand that the voting division of Diebold is a subsidiary. It used to go under the name of Global Election Systems. It's out of McKinney, Texas. Actually, it was out of Canada, but they called themselves out of McKinney, Texas. And Diebold, what they did was they bought this small company in Texas and kind of, they didn't really merge it in particularly. They just let it continue to run in McKinney, Texas with all its same people, its same software, and so forth. But the Diebold company itself is interesting. It does have very strong Republican ties, specifically to the Bush administration. They have a CEO named Wally O'Dell. He is a close crony of Dick Cheney. In fact, just recently in July, he had Cheney come to his house, and he held a fundraiser for Cheney that raised $500,000. They have a board of directors member who is one of the Bush pioneers. That's a small and elite group that gives huge amounts of money to the presidential campaign. This fellow's name is W.H. Timken, and you may remember that recently Bush had a trip to Ohio, and in this trip, indeed, who he went to visit was Timken, and he toured around in Timken's company, and of course Timken is also one of the directors of Diebold. And it just seems, the other thing that we noticed is we put together a spreadsheet of the contributions that were made by Diebold and Diebold employees. And they have a really unusual pattern of contributions, which ends up funneling literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to a few Republican candidates, very little to any other party.
What do you think is the most important thing? I put this question to both of you as we wrap up, that voters should understand, and do you think that we should remain with paper balloting?
Sure, let me take that.
Or non-computer balloting.
Sure. So computers in the voting place do have some valid uses. A computer can help prevent you from overvoting. It says you're only allowed to vote for one candidate. A computer can warn you if you're about to undervote, you know, to vote for nobody for a race. Computers can help make elections accessible to people with a variety of disabilities. So the computer is not a bad thing. The bad thing is when there's no what's called a voter verifiable audit trail. What I and many other computer scientists are advocating is that you have the computer in front and a printer in back. After you're done voting, it prints out a piece of paper that says on it everybody who you voted for. And if you agree with it, you press a button and it drops into a box. If you don't agree with it, you press another button and it gets shredded into confetti in front of your eyes. If you can see that, at that point, if you the voter, can see this card and read it and it says what you want it to say, then you no longer care what the software is doing, because you know that paper ballot will always have your intent on it. And in the event of a tight election, it can be recounted either by machine or by hand if it really matters. And we saw in Florida of 2000 that when it really matters, you can have people counting these things by hand, and that's important.
Bev Harris, last thoughts.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The paper ballot is critical because not only does it give you confidence in the system, and by the way, with no confidence in the American voting system, everything else falls apart fairly shortly. We have to keep this level of trust. But it's also proper auditing means you're comparing two independent sets of data and you're trying to match them up. And the key word there is independent. If the voter looks at a ballot and verifies it, then that's one source and the machine is the other source. You cannot have a system where the machine is simply checking itself. That's not an audit, and that's just as when you are audited by the IRS, if you go in there and you print off your own receipts on your home laser printer, that doesn't mean anything because there's no independent source. When you bring in a receipt from Best Buy and say, you know, that's what this is, the independent source is the store. So you have to have, for any kind of, and by the way, voting is accounting. It's a form of counting, and you have to follow simple, basic accounting procedures. And one of those procedures is proper auditability. You don't have proper auditability until you have two independent sources.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. It's certainly not the end of our discussion of this, just the beginning. Bev Harris, her book is coming out shortly, called Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. And Dan Wallach, professor of computer science at Rice University, co-author of the Johns Hopkins Report, Analysis of an Electronic Voting System. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to go to Chiapas, find out about the mass gathering and historic moment this weekend of the Zapatistas. And before that, we'll find out what the CIA predicted about post-invasion Iraq. Stay with us. Son de Liberación, Liberty Song by Los de Abajo, a band that supports the Zapatistas in Mexico. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be going to Chiapas in a minute, but first, 264 U.S. soldiers have now died since the invasion of Iraq began. 125 of those, or almost half, have been killed since the war was officially declared over on May 2nd, a raid of more than one a day. This should not come as a surprise to the Bush administration. According to an article in the Boston Globe, the CIA briefed the administration in February that the U.S. would face armed resistance from Iraqis following the fall of Saddam Hussein. A month after the briefing was produced, Vice President Dick Cheney told NBC's Meet the Press, quote, "My belief is we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators." The article goes on to say multiple briefings by both the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency were given to the National Security Council, including Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Vice President Dick Cheney, and President Bush himself. We're joined on the phone right now by Brian Bender, correspondent for the Boston Globe, based in Washington, D.C., did the piece called CIA Warned Administration of Post-War Guerrilla Peril. Talk about how you learned of the CIA report and briefings.
Well, actually, it goes back, I think, to even before the war, when there was some discussion among Pentagon officials, intelligence officials, some of my sources, that some of the predictions that they were hearing at the time from the Bush administration seemed to be overly optimistic about what the environment in Iraq would look like after the major fighting was over. And, you know, over the last couple of months, I've been able to piece together a little bit more detail about how many briefings, what indeed they said. And at least it appears that there was a concerted effort by some of the intelligence agencies to lay out what the post-war environment would look like. And I think if you look at what some of those reports said versus how prepared some of the troops are in Iraq now, I think there is some evidence of a disconnect that some of those warnings were not heeded. It's not exactly clear why, but certainly there is evidence that some of the administration had this optimistic view of what would happen and really didn't want to hear anything that would call that into question or call into question what they planned to do.
Who did you speak to?
I talked to some intelligence officials currently in the Defense Intelligence Agency, the CIA, as well as some former intelligence officials, folks who worked in the government, some up until earlier this year. And, you know, some of these reports go back to just a couple of months before the war, but there are, I've been told that there were reports even going back last year that had taken a look at what Iraq might look like if indeed the U.S. went in there. And so this is not something, these guerrilla attacks, these ambushes against U.S. troops, certainly, as you pointed out, shouldn't come as a surprise, although sometimes some officials make it sound that way. I recall that Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, a couple of weeks ago, had returned from Iraq after a 4 or 5 day whirlwind tour and gave an update in which he said there were some surprises. You know, not surprisingly, there were some surprises. Things did not turn out exactly the way we had intended. And one of the things he had pointed out is a big surprise is that some of the Ba'ath Party remnants, some of these diehards, would continue fighting. And that sort of struck me, given what we know about some of the warnings that were given before the war. So he certainly shouldn't have been as surprised as he made it sound.
And the Bush administration's allegiance to Ahmed Chalabi, who left Iraq in, 1958?
Yeah, that's a little murkier. People I've talked to claim that a lot of the sort of rosy, optimistic predictions that we heard out of some of the administration came, at least in large part, from Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi National Congress, which has been this exile group for many years that has pushed for regime change in Iraq, is said to have a close relationship with the Pentagon in particular. And so there's certainly some suspicion that the glowing predictions didn't come from nowhere. They came from Ahmed Chalabi and some other people in the Iraqi National Congress who were very much in support of a military invasion and perhaps you could argue, as a result, tried to paint, you know, a fairly pleasant picture of what Iraq would be like after the war.
And then, of course, you have Bush's July 2nd statement, despite the ongoing attacks of the Iraqis, taunting Iraqi militants who plan to attack American troops, saying, bring them on. And then the administration now trying to talk about the forces that are opposed, resisting the invasion, being pro-Saddam. I wanted to bring Jamie Wilson into this conversation. Brian Bender is with the Boston Globe. Jamie Wilson's reporter for The Guardian of London, just out of Basra. You did a piece called Basra, Betrayed and Pushed to the Brink. Who are the people who are rising up this past weekend? Major uprising there. Jamie.
I mean, they're just normal people, really, in Basra. I think Basra's in quite a unique situation. It's very different to Baghdad. The people in Basra were oppressed for years under Saddam Hussein, much worse than anybody in Baghdad was in terms of after the uprising in 1991, an estimated 250,000 people were killed in Baghdad by Saddam Hussein's regime. So they are, on the whole, very friendly towards the coalition, very welcoming towards the coalition. What happened in Basra over the weekend was a slightly unique event in that temperatures were rising up to sort of 57 degrees Celsius, which is unbelievably hot. As I'm sure people know in America, when it gets really hot on the streets, tempers start to fray. Add to that, there was a major problem with electricity in Basra over the weekend. I think the Coalition Provisional Authority claims that a lot of people were, or some people were had stripped some of the electricity wires and blown up some pylons, which resulted in big power problems at the power plant there. As a result, they couldn't get any electricity to the oil-making refinery where they make gas, so people couldn't buy gas to feed the generators to make electricity. And I think just a combination of these things, the people were welcoming the British forces and the US forces, but because they lost, you know, there was this incredible heat and the power and everything else, I think there was just sort of a spontaneous uprising, sort of, you know, 4 months on. I think they thought it was going to happen overnight, that the moment Saddam's regime was gone, life for them and Basra would get better. And I think it was part of the realization that actually that isn't going to be the case. It's going to take a long time for things to get better there. And I think it was just a general, you know, just a general uprising as a result of that. I don't think people should read too much into what happened in Basra. It certainly can't be compared to what's been happening in Baghdad in terms of the attacks against U.S. forces in the north of the country.
Brian Bender, we just have 30 seconds, but you're doing a new piece now on also what the CIA said about the domino effect. First, Saddam Hussein could be taken out, and then they'd move on around the Middle East.
Again, there's been a lot of talk of surprises and things not being predicted. One of the things we heard as a justification, if you will, for the war in Iraq was that this would be the first step in spreading democracy, pushing some of these autocratic regimes in the Middle East to reform. It turns out that some of the U.S. government's, many of the U.S. government's experts on the Middle East in the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA, also something called the National Intelligence Council, which is kind of a collection of representatives from different agencies, came out before the war and are continuing to say that this domino theory, as they call it, this new domino theory, where democracy would spread throughout the Middle East, really has no basis in reality. That they can't point to something or a reason to think that really is a possibility in the near term, midterm, let alone, you know, next week or next month when the Iraqis plan to have a constitutional convention and set up democracy, or at least the beginnings of democracy. So, again, I think it's all an example of, or another example of some of these instances where the policymakers in the Bush administration say one thing or make certain claims, whether it's weapons of mass destruction, democracy in the Middle East, Iraqis will welcome us with open arms, which doesn't really jive with what the quote-unquote experts in the U.S. government were briefing them, you know, on multiple occasions before the war.
Well, Brian Bender, I want to thank you for being with us from the Boston Globe, and Jamie Wilson from the Guardian of London speaking to us from Iraq. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to southern Mexico, in decisions that could have far-reaching consequences, the Zapatistas have declared political autonomy in 30 municipalities in Chiapas. The Zapatistas announced their plan for indigenous self-rule at their annual encuentro, or gathering, this past weekend. Zapatistas said they would withdraw fighters from roadblocks across the region. While most of the Zapatista leadership attended the gathering, the group's chief spokesperson, Subcomandante Marcos, was not there, though he did send a 5-minute recording. He called for the creation of 5 new good government boards called caracoles to oversee 5 different regions where the autonomous municipalities are located. He also said these caracoles, or good government boards, would be ruled by civilians, not the military wing of the Zapatistas. We're going to hear an excerpt of that tape translated by our producer. Stay with us.
The Army of National Liberation cannot be the voice of he who governs or the government, even if he who governs obeying and is a good government. The EZLN speaks for those of below, for the governed, for the Zapatista people who are their heart and blood, their thought and path. We shall be ready and waiting to defend them. That is why we are the Zapatista Army, the Botan Zapata, the guardian and heart of the people, And so, from here on, I shall no longer be the spokesperson for the rebel Zapatista autonomous municipalities. They already have someone who speaks and speaks well for them. In my role as military commander of the Zapatista troops, I am informing you that as of now, the autonomous councils will not be able to have recourse to the military forces for government work. They should therefore try very hard to do as all governments do, that is, to have recourse to reason and not to force in order to govern. Armies should not be used in order to defend, not in order to govern. An army's work is not to be a police force or a public ministry. Consequently, as our comandantes should be informing you, all those checkpoints and control points shall be withdrawn, which under autonomous authority our forces have been maintaining along the roads and highways, as well as the collecting of taxes from individuals.
And that is the recording of Subcomandante Marcos, the recording that was played at the gathering this weekend in Chiapas, the Zapatista gathering. It was translated by Lenina Nadal, our producer. We're joined on the line by Luz Ruiz, who is with the Chiapas Media Project in Chiapas right now. You were at the gathering. Can you describe it?
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Member of the Chiapas Independent Media Center, which translates into English to the Indy Media Center. But yes, I was present this weekend, and it was a pretty festive, pretty emotional moment where more than, well, close to 10,000 people gathered from the communities, from different states here in Mexico, and also from the international community. So it was a very emotional moment there for everybody that has been supporting and believes in the causes that the ECLN has brought up in the last 10 years that they have been public and verbal.
Can you talk about the women Zapatistas who spoke?
Yes, the women Zapatistas that spoke were Comandante Esther, Comandante Rosalinda, and Comandante Fidelia. And in a very emotional, very energetic and speech was Comandante Fidelia, because he specifically addressed men, saying that this time the Zapatista women are not going to ask permission to the men to respect them.
Luz, I wanted to play an excerpt of Fidelia.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Even today, there are many places in Mexico where women are abused, unappreciated, exploited, and they say that we're not worth anything, that we don't have any rights. But today, the time has come. We will do it because it's an obligation.
And that was Comandante Fidelia speaking this weekend at the Encuentro or Gathering in Chiapas. And I want to thank Luz Ruiz from the Chiapas Media Project. That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website and sign up for our daily digest, as thousands of people have, by going to www.democracynow.org. It also shows links to all the different organizations and people that we have spoken to, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Lenina Nadal, Elizabeth Press, Parvez Sharma, and Olpa Patel. Elizabeth Press as well, Mike DiFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.